come up with a reason why they're giving this money to Anthem and where this money is coming from. And what Mr. Peterson states is this money is a $1 million fee. If you look in the testimony of, I believe it's Mr. Holsworth, around transcript volume 3, somewhere in the 125 to 7 page range, there's discussion that there was a previous financing that was done with Anthem. This was not something that was charged in the case, but there was a previous financing that was done in the fall of 1995 for, I think it was health insurance benefits, a different insurance. As part of that, that money went to pay for health insurance, but there was tacked on a $1 million fee that was supposed to be Mr. Peterson's administrative fee. So this is the fee that they're talking about. They're saying this fee that you already gave us, that fees that don't go to the insurance company, that go to us, can be sort of held in trust. We're paying this money back to you. It's all a sham. It's all a big sham that all of the parties are aware of and are working with together. So there's nothing in there that indicates what's principally important, which is, does Anthem know when they're being given premium financings?
So no one is deceiving anyone? Everyone is in on this?
No one is deceiving any. Well, yes, Anthem is being deceived, and AI Credit is being deceived. AI Credit was deceived into loaning $1 million by Legion and by Monon to loan the $1 million in the first place. Anthem is thinking that this money is coming from Peterson's $1 million fee that they already loaned, which they thought went to Peterson. That money didn't go to Peterson. That money went to Monon. In fact, Monon jokes that sometimes Mr. Rosby and Mr. Peterson, like, we would give Mr. Peterson these $500,000 or these $1 million fees.
So Peterson and Monon
are deceiving
Anthem.
That's correct. That is correct, Your Honor. That is exactly what is occurring here. Peterson has already deceived Anthem once into thinking that a $1 million administrative fee went to him. They are now deceiving them into thinking that he's giving that $1 million fee back. In reality, the first $1 million fee went to Monon to try to keep the company afloat. Now the second $1 million that they're getting back isn't coming from Monon. It's coming from deceit against AI Credit. These are sophisticated lenders, but these are also sophisticated criminals. They're coming up, they're working together, Mr. Peterson and Mr. Rosby and Mr. Franklin, to come up with cover stories and working with Legion to deceive these lenders. They know how the industry works, and they know where the loopholes are. Now, Anthem, Mr. Franklin is correct. Anthem is in the business of lending money, and they are interested in lending money, but they don't know that the money that they are lending is money that's going straight to Monon and is unsecured. They think that this money that's coming in and out is being secured. If the money had been an administrative fee that had gone to Peterson, Peterson has to hold it in trust. They can sue Peterson. Peterson has this money in trust, and if there's a default or a bankruptcy, they can put a claim in, a lien in on Peterson, just like on the insurance premiums, they can put a lien in on the money that goes to the insurance company. What, of course, happens is Monon goes bankrupt. None of this money went to Peterson. None of this money went to Legion. All of this money went to Monon and went out the door, and that's why the lenders are out the money, because they've turned what they thought were secured loans into unsecured loans. Does that clarify things at all for you, Judge Roman?
I'm not sure.
Okay. In any event, the bottom line point, though, Judge Rovner, to get back to the beginning, is a jury could still look at all of this evidence and reasonably conclude that they didn't know. This is essentially a...
So Peterson gets none of this.
If you read...
And he pleads guilty.
Peterson does get money. Peterson does get certain fees, and Peterson gets a couple of $100,000, I think, out of this, but I'm not sure
none of this million.
None of that million, no. He never had that million. There are other instances in AI Credit number one, which would be the second overall premium financing, the first one with AI Credit. There, again, is an administrative fee, I think, of $300,000 tacked on. That money is added on because the amount of the Legion policy, which they had now double financed, wasn't going to be enough to cover the trailer deal with CFI, so they added in a line. If you actually look at the exhibits, they added in a line and said Peterson and Associates administrative fee. Mr. Peterson testified, I didn't get that money. And if you look at the way the money flows, that's where the money flows. The money comes in and Peterson sends money to CFI, or Peterson sends money to Anthem. Peterson never sends any money to Legion and Company, except for a very small percentage of the final premium financing when they actually have to start making payments. Of course, what's funny about the whole premium financing is Legion wasn't demanding that they pay the money up front this time around. Legion wasn't demanding that. That's why you do a premium financing. The company wants the money up front, and you pay monthly premiums to the premium finance company. Legion was only demanding money on a monthly basis, and so they didn't need any of this money until they needed a 12th of it when the policy came due. So they don't even start using any of this money until July when they have to start paying premiums. On the Congress issue, Your Honors, Mr. Franklin wants to cite to the March 1996 audit. But if you look at the record and if you look at what is showed, in March 1996, Monon caught up. They were given notice. The evidence is in the record. Monon could build $1 million worth of trailers a day. So even though these are large amounts of time, at sometimes they're only 4, 5, 6 days behind. The March audit, the testimony from Mr. Chapman and Mr. Hogan, was a process that took possibly 3 weeks. They looked at all aspects of Monon's business. And so what happens? The auditors come in. They're parked in a conference room. They're stalled. They're given other documents. And 5, 6 days later, when they finally get out in the field and start checking the trailers, Monon knows which trailers they've reported. They alter their production schedule to build those trailers. So they're being very sophisticated in trying to conceal all of these things from Congress. The other thing to note is that they've been engaging in bill-aheads for a long time. Suddenly, March 1996 happens. The audit is coming. They can't defraud Congress at this point in time. What do they do? Well, in March 1996 is when the premium financing fraud starts. They find a new source to get the money that they need and to defraud individuals. On AI credit, I just wanted to talk briefly about the overfunding. The overfunding does not prove knowledge for a number of different reasons. In the first place, what the overfunding is there was a premium in 1995, so the previous year, of $4.5 million. AI credit sent $4.5 million through the broker to Legion. Now, it's an overfunding only because what that means is that Monon only has to keep a certain amount of money on reserve in Bermuda in the premium finance account to fund both the 1995 policy year and all of the previous policy years. At some point, Legion is going to say, we believe there's enough money in the account, considering claims, considering history, that we may have money in reserve from previous years' financing, say 1993, 1994. We don't think you need to keep that money in here anymore to cover future workman's comp claims. Once that premium was paid, there was enough money in the account that $1.5 million from previous workman's comp financings could go back. They'd been funding all of these through AI credit, and so Cindy Carroll allowed that to occur. Now, what John Rigaud testifies is, had he known that this overfunding was coming back, it would have affected his credit analysis, and he might have charged a higher interest. Essentially, I don't know if this is made quite clear in the record, but what I think you can read through the lines is he might have charged a higher interest rate, he might have demanded additional protections, but not that there is anything illegal about this in any way, shape, or form. The money comes in, the money is paid to Legion, as Legion discloses, and it comes back out and then goes for whatever purpose it is supposed to go to. Even if one did believe the defendant's version, which is that something is contrary, there's something funny going on here, they contact Legion. Legion says, here's where the money's coming, here's where the money is going. On the later premium financings, they contact Legion, and Legion, McPherson said, gives his verifications, or someone else at Legion gives their verifications. They have no reason to know that everything isn't above board. All of this had been disclosed before, and now it's being concealed from them. And again, this was argued to the jury. I mean, this was one of the central arguments to the jury. The two central arguments to the jury were, number one, the Scrushy defense. Mr. Rosby and Mr. Franklin didn't know anything, and Mr. Peterson and other low-level employees did all of this for the benefit of the company without them knowing. And number two, the victims knew. Everybody knew that Congress wasn't fully secured. Everybody at the premium finance companies knew that the money was not going for premium financing, but they wanted to build their loan portfolios, so they lent the money anyway. This was a defense. It was aired to the jury, and they rejected it. So Is there evidence in the record?
The jury rejected? No, I asked the question, was there a jury instruction asking the jury to find whether the lenders actually knew the truth? And the answer was no.
There was no, that is correct.
So how did the jury determine that they did not actually know the truth?
Well,
which is what you just said.
As Mr. Franklin stated, what Mr. Franklin's stating is it would have been incapable. What the materiality instruction stated, would this misstatement have had the capability or potential to influence the lenders? If the lenders knew that the money wasn't going where it said it was going, if the lenders knew that this was wrong, then it would not have had the capability or potential to influence them. But in any event, it's a plain error standard, Your Honor, if the court believes that there was error. They submitted the same instruction on materiality, essentially, that we did. And they did not submit any instruction saying that the defendant must actually know. So there's no plain error in that instruction.
That the defendant must actually know. No, I don't understand what that has to do with anything.
I'm sorry, that the victim actually knew. I must have misspoken.
It's not that they must actually know. It's that if they actually knew, then there was no crime.
That's correct, Your Honor. But that's the way that this case was argued to the juror. There's no plain error.
Just as a minor point, this business of Peterson driving from Monon to Indianapolis, your brief and theirs doesn't quite cross on this. So they say he left Monon at 5 and turned in his car at the airport at 6, and there are 91 miles between those two points.
If you read the trial testimony, Your Honor, what the trial testimony... Mr. Rosby submitted a receipt saying I left at 3:06. This was, in fact, after Mr. Peterson's
testimony.
No,
that's Rosby. But what about the Peterson?
Mr. Peterson said, what Mr. Peterson's testimony is would be in the record. He said, I believe my flight that night would have been around 7 or 8 to get to the airport in time. I would have had to have left by around 5 or 6. That's what he testifies to.
No, but he turned his car in at 6. Doesn't matter where the plane was.
That's correct. Well, I think what the evidence shows, Your Honor, is probably if the meeting occurred.
Did he say when
he said he thought he left around 5 o'clock? If this meeting occurred, which the government submits it did, it would have occurred around 4:30 or 4:45. The government would submit that is around 5 o'clock. That for purposes of trial testimony occurring 6 years after the fact, if someone says I left at 5 o'clock and they actually left at 4:45. I think, again, if this had been submitted at the trial, certainly there could have been issues and there could have been credibility questions that are asked. But
was it available or discoverable?
It certainly would have been discoverable. We turned over, this is all in our brief, we turned over all of these records so they knew that he had a Hertz rental car. They knew what time... They knew from the discovery that the meeting was essentially alleged to have occurred on that day. So if they wanted to attempt to search around for records, which they did post-trial... there's no reason to believe that they could not have done this before trial. I think what the evidence shows, Your Honor, candidly, is the meeting would not have occurred at 5 o'clock. The meeting would have occurred about 4:45 or 4:40, somewhere in that range. Of course, this also assumes, Your Honor, which I guess for purposes of the procedural posture here we have to accept, but this assumes that when the clerk at Hertz writes down 6 o'clock, that's, in fact, 6:00 and not some sort of estimate or some sort of rounding back to the nearest hour like that.
No. Oh, it's exact.
I'm sorry?
What, the little receipt that Hertz gives you when you turn a car in? That's
yes.
The exact time.
The clerk writes down the number of the time that you come in. I'm not disputing that, Your Honor. I'm saying for purposes of this argument, yes, that's where we're at. The meeting could have occurred.
Do you have any comment on the departure issue that we heard about from Mr. Shapiro?
Yes, Your Honor. On the departure issue, the briefs on this essentially were all written in 2003, and a motion to depart by both parties was submitted. Both parties at their sentencing stood up and said, we want to argue our motion to depart. In fact, if you look at the transcripts and what Judge Moody does, Judge Moody appears to he recognizes that we're not in departure land still. He doesn't go through and evaluate the the factors, I find that diminished capacity isn't met under 5K, I'm forgetting the statute now, for these reasons. In fact, he says in the transcript of Rosby at page 111, I'm going to set the downward departure issue aside because all I have to do is analyze the guidelines. That seems to me to be anticipating this court's rulings that he doesn't have to raise the departure issue per se, and he's just going to consider it at the end, and he states that he did. So in terms of does this departure methodology issue matter when he's argued plain error, he's captioned his title motion to depart, he discusses it in departure terms. Mr. Franklin, the issue is the sentencing of Mr. Franklin is very thin. Essentially, he doesn't even argue the issue. So all that's in the record there is a motion to depart and Mr. Franklin's allocution where he says, please keep in mind I have high school age and middle school age children. So that's I don't think that the court speaking of it as I understand there's a motion to depart that's been filed, I choose not to depart, is something that is rises to the level of error, that kind of level of error. On the other issues, the restitution issue follows essentially straightforward. I don't know if the court has any questions or concerns about loss amount. The loss amount is the amount that's undersecured on the loan. The total fraud was $41.6 million if you went and counted up every trailer that was reported early. But at the time that the fraud was discovered, the amount of the loss is $5.9 million. And, in fact, that's in Exhibit 2. The defendants, at the time Congress discovers the fraud, Congress says, we want to dig ourselves out of this hole. We don't want to send you into bankruptcy. But you have to sign this forbearance agreement. And in the forbearance...
Okay, what's the actual amount of money lost, let's say? Is it the 5.9
yes.
mil?
Yes, Your Honor. The $5.9 million, which is in the agreement that they signed.
Okay.
Because it's the amount that, I mean, this is intended loss. This is straight from Lane.
Later.
It's the amount that they're undersecured, and they signed off on that. So that, I believe, is a pretty straightforward issue, Your Honor. The variance issue, this is in the back. First of all, it's in the background section of the brief. I don't know how it prevented them from having an adequate opportunity to prepare their defense. But all that paragraph says is, the finance agreement says X, and the finance agreement says that. The finance agreement says we're going to lend based off of completed trailers. Now, for accounting convenience purposes, they were allowed to call in based on the previous day's scheduled starts. But what the defense at trial was they were reporting on the basis of some production schedule that just got way out of whack, and there's no evidence that the variance caused any of those problems here. I see I'm running out of time. The only other issue was the victim impeachment issue, and we certainly don't think that the district judge abused its discretion. The only strange thing about that issue is that the district court issued its ruling in January, and the defendants filed their briefs in December. And I raised a jurisdictional argument, which I'm probably wrong about, Your Honors, but I didn't understand exactly how they could brief an issue that hadn't yet been decided by the district court. In any event, I don't know that it matters because none of this victim impeachment stuff would have affected anything at the trial.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Holler. So, does Mr. Franklin have any time? 1 minute?
I just want to very briefly address a couple of factual issues. Regarding the audit again conducted by Congress, there isn't any evidence that when they came in to do that audit, the complete audit, that people were in a conference room all alone, not watching what's going on. That's just not in the record, okay? What the record says is that they conducted a complete audit over a period of a month and checked every trailer on the premises. That's all the record says. And secondly, with respect to Anthem and this issue of the $1 million fee and the secret agreement between Anthem and Peterson, I just want to make clear what we think that shows. Supposedly, Anthem was deceived about this $1 million fee. Well, clearly, Anthem knew that Mr. Peterson wasn't getting the fee from Monon. Okay, so they entered into an agreement to help him recover his fee. But the importance of that fact is that Anthem clearly had actual knowledge that the fee wasn't being paid. It knew. So those are the two points that I wanted to make about the facts of the case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Shapiro, how much time do you have? 1 minute also?
Just thank you. Just very briefly, Your Honor, an academic, almost amicus point, that I'm not sure that this court meant to declare 5K1 substantial assistance departures obsolete along with the other departures. 5K1 substantial assistance departures are obviously a form of departure, and just so future parties may not misunderstand this court's holding in Johnson and its progeny, perhaps that requires a bit of clarification. The only other point I wanted to make, Your Honor, is that the district court said at sentencing, even though departure is authorized in this case, in the exercise of its discretion, the court will not depart because I believe departure is not warranted under the facts and circumstances of this case. Transcript volume 16 at page 119, lines 15 through 20. The record is very clear that the district court analyzed the family circumstances and diminished capacity issues in departure terms and not the 3553A factors.
And were the family circumstances just what Mr. Holler said?
The family, in terms of the two teenage sons, okay. Your Honor, the family circumstances might not have been extraordinary family circumstances under departure methodology. But
well, there was a suicide, wasn't there?
In my client's family, Your Honor, absolutely. In fact, during the period of the indictment, his son killed himself. That even that might not amount to diminished capacity or Mr. Franklin's family circumstances under the old departure methodology, which is far more...
What were Franklin's family circumstances?
I believe he had a number of children, Your Honor, more than two children, I believe, and they were all school age, and they were living in North Carolina, I believe, and his incarceration obviously would be very hard on his wife and children, and that's probably no different than many other cases, Your Honor. Thus would probably not survive family circumstances scrutiny under the more rigorous departure methodology.
I don't think it would withstand scrutiny under any test myself.
Well, actually, Your Honor, just 2 days ago I received a sub-guideline sentence from 70 months in the low-end advisory guideline sentence all the way down to 24 months from a district court judge based on family circumstances that were not...
So you may be seeing us again real soon.
I don't think the government is going to appeal it, Your Honor, but I think that the district court's judgment was reasonable, very reasonable, in light of these family circumstances. But I would be surprised if the government appeals it. But thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much.